Welcome to the debate. Today, we are examining the core mechanisms of civilizational stability and collapse. And we're drawing on the analytical framework presented in the Violence, Viability, Architecture, Life Ground Governance, and the Dynamics of Civilizational Stability by Dr. Bechara Sali and ChatGPT. The central question before us is this. When complex civilizations face cascading fragility and, frankly, potential collapse, what is the primary driver of their failure? I will be arguing that civilizational failure is at its root a crisis of institutional capture and political economy. Specifically, I contend that collapse is driven by vested interests manufacturing constraints and deliberately sabotaging the adaptive governance required to navigate crises. I am joined by my colleague who takes a fundamentally different view, arguing that civilizational collapse is driven instead by ecological limits and temporal elasticity, which is the inescapable mathematics of physical overshoot.
Yeah, thank you. My position is indeed that while governance and institutional design are obviously important, they are ultimately subordinate factors. The true fundamental driver of civilizational collapse is ecological overshoot combined with what the source material calls temporal elasticity. Essentially, systems mask their own physical decay. They hide the rot until a sudden, irreversible collapse becomes mathematically and physically unavoidable, entirely regardless of our institutional designs or political intentions.
Right. Let me begin by laying out my position in a bit more detail, because I want to be clear about what I am and what I am not arguing here. The framework we are analyzing places immense importance on the life ground. Now, for those familiar with the text, you know the life ground refers to the ecological foundations, the water, the climate, the topsoil that literally sustains human survival. I absolutely do not deny that this is essential. However, it is human institutions that act as the vital shock absorbers between those ecological realities and human survival. When societies face severe ecological or economic stress, failure is rarely due to an absolute lack of physical capacity or technical solutions. Instead, it is a crisis of what the authors call the political economy of non-adaptation.
Right, the idea that we choose not to adapt.
Exactly. What we often perceive as a hard scarcity of resources is in reality a manufactured constraint. Elites and vested interests intentionally maintain what the text calls dominant stability. To put it plainly, they externalize the costs of ecological and economic decay onto marginalized populations through sacrificial governance. They block necessary transitions, like, say, the shift away from fossil fuels or the restructuring of water rights, simply to preserve sunk investments and profit from the very scarcity that is destabilizing the civilization. We fail to adapt not because we lack the physical means or the scientific know-how, but because powerful actors actively sabotage our institutions to protect their own advantages.
Your focus on institutional agency is understandable, and it highlights a real mechanism of inequality. But it is ultimately subordinate to the life ground. As the text explicitly notes, no institution, no matter how perfectly designed, how equitable, or how free from elite capture, can indefinitely overcome severe ecological degradation. Institutions can redistribute scarcity, but they cannot eliminate physical limits. My position centers on that critical concept of temporal elasticity. Civilizations frequently maintain the mere appearance of stability through something called cross-layer cannibalization.
Let's actually unpack that term for a moment, because it sounds incredibly dense, but the mechanism is something we see every day.
It is. Think of cross-layer cannibalization like paying off your mortgage with a high-interest credit card. You haven't solved your financial deficit. You've just moved the liability from one layer to another, buying yourself a little bit of time while the underlying debt compounds. In civilizational terms, we mask our ecological depletion by expanding financial debt, or we compensate for institutional weakness by increasing state coercion. This creates a systemic lag. Because of the buffers and reserves in our ecological and social systems, we experience legitimacy drag. The cultural facade holds up, the daily routines continue, and the system looks entirely legitimate, even as the foundation completely rots away beneath it.
And you're arguing that by the time we notice the rot, it's too late.
Precisely. By the time institutions actually try to react to the crisis, even if they are freed from the vested interest you mentioned earlier, hysteresis has already occurred. The text uses this term, hysteresis, which essentially means irreversible damage. Think of it like stretching a rubber band. You can stretch it for a long time, that's our societal buffer, our temporal elasticity. But once it snaps, you can't just ease up on the tension and expect it to go back to normal. The system is permanently changed. The loss of topsoil, the exhaustion of fossil aquifers, the breaking of planetary boundaries, these are irreversible ratchets. We hit a state of overshoot, and sudden collapse becomes physically unavoidable.
Let's look closely at the efficacy of transformational institutional repair. The source material outlines specific historical pathways of repair that demonstrate this perfectly. Take the European Coal and Steel Community, the ESCSE, formed after the devastation of the Second World War.
A classic example of institutional innovation.
A brilliant structural innovation. European states took the essential physical resources required for military industry, coal and steel, and placed them under a shared supranational authority. They institutionalized economic interdependence, effectively making unilateral military escalation structurally impossible. They didn't just ask nicely for peace, they changed the architecture of the political economy. Or consider the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the TRC. This wasn't just a cultural shift or a polite conversation. It was the active institutionalization of what the paper calls HDT, holism, dialectics, and transcendence.
Meaning they created a formal structure to process the conflict rather than just suppressing it.
Exactly. By creating a formal mechanism to process collective trauma, to grant conditional amnesty in exchange for truth, they broke the cycles of revenge that typically lead to civil war. They transcended the zero-sum game. These examples prove that when we design proper institutions, when we actively rewire the rules of the game, we can successfully redirect societies away from escalating violence and collapse, regardless of the physical pressures.
That's a compelling argument. But have you considered the underlying material conditions that allowed those specific reforms to succeed? I acknowledge the brilliance of the ESCS and the TRC, but we have to be honest about the context. They occurred during highly unique periods of resource availability and geopolitical alignment. The post-war European reconstruction wasn't just a triumph of supranational policy, it was heavily subsidized by an immense influx of external resources and energy, specifically the Marshall Plan and a massive ramp up in cheap fossil fuels. The South African transition, similarly, occurred in a specific geopolitical vacuum at the end of the Cold War.
But the material conditions didn't dictate the success of the institutions. The institutions directed the use of those materials.
The text rightfully praises civil commons institutions, like welfare states or shared resource agreements, as great stabilizers. But we must be brutally realistic about their limitations. A welfare state cannot manufacture water. A supranational coal and steel authority cannot stabilize the global climate system. Earlier, you used the analogy of institutions as shock absorbers. I agree with that analogy. But what happens when the shock isn't just a bump in the road? What happens when the road itself crumbles into the ocean? If the life ground collapses, the shock absorbers are destroyed along with it. You cannot legislate a depleted aquifer back into existence through shared interdependence.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective on how those shock absorbers actually function. Let's pivot from these massive macro-level historical examples and look at how these structures impact the micro-level, the daily biological reality of the citizens living under them. The framework gets into something fascinating here regarding the biological transmission mechanisms of stability. It's not just about resource allocation on a spreadsheet. It's physiological.
You're talking about the autonomic nervous system.
Yes. When institutions provide robust care infrastructures, when a society guarantees access to healthcare, secure housing, and food security, they literally stabilize the human autonomic state. They prevent the chronic systemic activation of the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, the HPA axis. We all know this as the fight or flight response. When people are living in precarious conditions, worried about their next meal or eviction, their HPA axis is constantly firing. By reducing that material stress, these civil commons literally increase a population's cognitive bandwidth and problem-solving capacity.
Which the paper argues is essential for avoiding systemic violence.
It's the absolute prerequisite. This is how we prevent populations from falling into what the authors call narrative tractors of tribalism and zero-sum competition. If people aren't chronically stressed, they don't look for scapegoats. If we build the right institutions, we regulate the distributed physiological entrainment of the civilization. We keep the collective nervous system in a state of safety and social engagement. That bandwidth is exactly what we need to innovate and navigate whatever ecological constraints we face.
I come at it from a different way. While the biological transmission of material stress is a crucial insight from the architecture, you are ignoring the standalone, independent destructive power of modern information systems.
How so?
The information systems are just another layer of infrastructure.
They are, but they function differently now. The digital attention economy and algorithmic polarization artificially induce physiological stress and emotional contagion completely independently of material conditions. We now have an information layer that is optimized to trigger the exact HPA axis activation you are talking about. It prioritizes fear, outrage, and moral condemnation simply because it maximizes user engagement. Think about doom scrolling. You could have a society where institutions distribute resources perfectly, where there is no acute ecological shortage, where housing and healthcare are guaranteed, and yet the fragmentation of the epistemic commons and strategic disinformation can still trigger a fragility cascade.
But the epistemic commons, our shared understanding of reality, only fragments when people are already materially insecure.
I disagree. The algorithms can simulate existential threats even when none exist materially. When the population's shared reality fragments into parallel interpretive communities, public discourse shifts entirely from problem-solving to identity conflict. You cannot fix that cognitive narrowing just by providing better housing or universal basic income if the media environment in their pocket is continuously artificially pumping their nervous systems full of cortisol.
I'm not convinced by that line of reasoning because it ignores who is directing that information environment and why. It brings us right back to the political economy of non-adaptation. The algorithmic polarization you describe doesn't exist in a vacuum. It isn't a force of nature. It is highly profitable for a specific set of actors. This brings up one of the most vital diagnostic priorities in the paper, which is the vested interest audit.
Auditing the bad actors?
Exactly. To save a civilization, the ultimate tool is to target regulatory capture. We have to ask the hard questions. Who benefits from the crisis? Who are the institutional gatekeepers obstructing reform? What narratives are being deliberately amplified by these algorithms to justify the continuation of existing extractive policies? The fragility cascade is not a spontaneous occurrence. It is a product of sabotage. Resolving this requires political mobilization to break the lock-in effects of sunk investments. If we merely focus on ecological data, or if we just throw our hands up at algorithmic patterns without confronting the specific elites who profit from scarcity and division, we are fundamentally misdiagnosing the disease.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why. Focusing purely on political bad actors and vested interests is a very comforting illusion. It's comforting because it implies the problem can be solved by simply removing the corrupt gatekeepers. Vote out the bad guys, audit the tech CEOs, and everything goes back to normal. It completely ignores the silent, physical mathematics of the expanded viability function.
You mean the V of T equation from the paper?
Yes, the equation. V of T equals F of LICPT. Civilizational viability as a function of time is determined by life ground, institutions, culture, power, and time. You are hyper-focusing on P, the power distribution, and I, the institutions, and yes, they matter. But the ultimate constraints, the ones that deal the fatal blow, are L, life ground integrity, and T, temporal resilience. The most dangerous threats to a civilization are not the tech billionaires or the captured regulators. The most dangerous threats are the leading indicators of exhausted elasticity. I am talking about declining water tables, soil degradation, and irreversible biodiversity loss.
But those indicators decline precisely because the power distribution allows it.
Even if that were true, at a certain point, the origin of the damage doesn't matter. You can audit vested interests all day. You can mobilize incredible grassroots reform coalitions, but you cannot negotiate with physics. Once the ecological buffers are gone, the system ratchets down permanently. Remember the hysteresis analogy with the rubber band? Once a coral reef collapses, or once the topsoil blows away after decades of intensive farming, the foundational capacity to support your complex institutions vanishes.
The political sabotage you are describing is merely a secondary symptom. It's the squabbling on the deck of a ship that has already hit the boundaries of its physical carrying capacity.
But that view treats ecological overshoot as if it falls from the sky, entirely divorced from the very institutions that govern extraction. The exhaustion of those ecological buffers is a direct result of manufactured constraints. Look at energy transitions. We see this globally right now. They are often delayed not because the renewable technologies are physically unavailable or because we have hit an absolute ecological limit for human thriving, but because incumbent industries wield sufficient political influence to slow regulatory change. The decay of the life ground is facilitated by captured institutions.
Facilitated, perhaps, but the physics of the decay remain absolute.
But if we utilize the vested interest audit to identify and dismantle the obstruction mechanisms, the corporate lobbying, the strategic litigation, the disinformation campaigns you mentioned earlier, we unlock the capacity for adaptive repair. Civilizational viability requires aggressive institutional reform to expand the civil commons. We have to ensure that human agency isn't perpetually blocked by manufactured scarcity. If we ensure that resources are not cannibalized by a select few, the life ground has a much, much greater capacity for regeneration than you are giving it credit for.
Regeneration has physical limits, and tea time is the variable you are severely underestimating in that equation. The temporal delay between structural degradation and a highly visible crisis is precisely why civilizations collapse. By the time your reform coalitions recognize the crisis, mobilize the public, audit the algorithms, and overcome the vested interests, the system is already past the tipping point. The reserves have been spent.
You're assuming the timeline for political reform is always slower than the timeline for ecological collapse.
I'm observing that it historically is, because of legitimacy drag. Think about a local water crisis or a sudden power grid failure. The day before the reservoir runs dry or the grid goes down, the system looks entirely normal. The cultural facade holds up, the institutions maintain their daily routine operations, and the public believes the system is functional, right up until the exact moment it isn't. Governance matters, absolutely. But true viability requires a profound respect for ecological boundaries and a hypervigilant eye on the temporal lag that masks systemic decay. If we do not read the leading indicators correctly, if we wait for the lagging indicators like social unrest or financial collapse to mobilize your political reforms, the hysteresis effect guarantees that the complex society cannot be salvaged in its current form.
It is true that the temporal lag poses a severe threat. If the gap between the narrative of stability and the reality of decay widens too far, institutional authority can erode with terrifying speed. However, as the adaptive repair cycle of civilizations outlines in the text, when crises expose structural fragilities, it triggers intense narrative contestation. It forces the issue. If reflexive narratives and reform coalitions prevail during that window of crisis, institutional redesign can restore resilience. I maintain that the original formula of viability, that viability equals life ground times institutions times culture, demonstrates that these elements are deeply interlocked. While you emphasize the absolute ceiling of the life ground, I emphasize that our proximity to that ceiling is dictated by institutional mediation.
I can certainly agree that ecological constraints and institutional mediation function as a tightly coupled system. It isn't an either-or in the strictest sense. Ecology sets the hard boundaries of possibility, and institutions determine our pathway through those boundaries. If we're to navigate what the authors call the viability corridor, avoiding the extremes of chaotic collapse on one side and authoritarian extraction on the other, it undeniably requires both structural integrity and the political will to enact reform. My caution remains, however, that we must not mistake political victories for physical realities. We can win the election, we can rewrite the laws, but the ecological buffers will only stretch so far before they snap.
And my caution is that we must not view physical constraints as an excuse to ignore the deliberate asymmetrical power structures that dictate exactly who suffers when those physical limits are approached. Diagnosing systemic fragility in an era of converging pressures is an incredibly complex task. The violence viability architecture offers a profound map of these interacting dynamics, integrating biological stress, informational environments, and political economy into a single lens.
But the map is not the territory. The ultimate test is how our societies choose to interpret their own warning signals and whether we have the collective capacity to implement the systemic repair necessary to sustain civilizational viability.
A profound map indeed, and a vital conversation. There is certainly much more to explore, Oz, in this material.
Thank you for the exchange. And to our listeners, thank you for joining us on The Debate.